10. Over the next week, as he had the week before, he wrote every day to Edward. Edward had promised that he would send him his sister's address in his first letter, but he had been gone almost 2 weeks, and there had not been a single piece of correspondence. David had inquired at the boarding house if they had an address for him, and had even suffered an encounter with the terrifying matron, but neither had yielded further information. And yet he continued to write, a letter a day, which he had one of the servants leave at Edward's boarding house in case he should inform them of his location. He could feel his aimlessness transforming itself into desperation, and every evening he set himself a plan for the following day, one that would keep him away from Washington Square until just past the first post delivery, by which point he would be either alighting from the hansom or rounding the corner on foot, returning from his trip to the museum, or the club, or a chat with Eliza, who was the sibling he liked best, and to whom he sometimes paid a visit when he knew Eden was attending class. Grandfather had, pointedly, asked him nothing about his dinner with Charles Griffith, and nor had David volunteered anything. Life resumed its pre-Edward rhythms, but this time the days were grayer than before. Now he made himself wait until half past the hour when the mail arrived before finally ascending the stairs, and he made himself not ask Adams or Matthew whether anything had come for him, as if by not doing so he might cause a letter to materialize to reward him for his discipline and patience. But day after day passed, and the post brought only 2 letters from Charles, both asking if he might want to attend the theater. The first one he declined, courteously and quickly, begging family obligations. The second he ignored, angry at it for not being from Edward, until he was on the verge of being rude, whereupon he jotted a brief note apologizing and saying he had caught a chill and was staying indoors. At the beginning of the 3rd week of Edward's absence, he took the hansom west, and the day's letter in hand, determined to uncover answers himself about Edward's whereabouts. But the only person he found at the boarding house was the wan little maid who seemed to spend most of her time lugging a pail of brackish-looking water from one floor to the next.
"I dunno, sir," she mumbled, looking doubtfully at David's shoes, recoiling from the letter he held out for her as if it might burn her. "He dinna say when he'll be back."
He left the house then, but stood on the sidewalk, looking up at Edward's windows, over which the dark curtains were fully drawn, the same as they had been for the past 16 days. That evening, though, he remembered something that might help him, and as he and his grandfather assumed their after-dinner positions, he asked, "Grandfather, have you heard of a woman named Florence Larson?" His grandfather appraised him, coolly, before tamping down the tobacco in his pipe and puffing.
"Florence Larson," he repeated. "That's a name I've not heard in a very long time. Why do you ask?"
"Oh, Charles was mentioning that his clerk lived in a boarding house she owns," he said, dismayed not just by the speed of his duplicity, but by his involving Charles in it.
"So it's true," his grandfather murmured, almost to himself, before sighing. "I never knew her myself, mind you. She's even older than I am. Frankly, I'm surprised she's still alive. But when she was around your age, she was involved in an awful scandal."
"What happened?"
"Well, she was the only daughter of a quite well-to-do man, a doctor, I believe, and was herself studying to be a doctor. Then one night she met a man, I cannot remember his name, at a party thrown by her cousin. He was apparently spectacularly handsome and deeply charming, and utterly penniless. One of those men who seem to come from nowhere and are connected to no one, and yet through their appearance and witty conversation are able to find themselves in society among all the best people."
"And so what happened?"
"What often happens in these circumstances, I'm sorry to say. He wooed her. She fell in love. Her father threatened to disown her if she married the man. And she did so anyway. She had a fortune bestowed upon her by her late mother, and soon after they married, the man absconded with it all. Every last cent. She was left destitute, and while she was able to return to her father's house, he was so spiteful, a very cold-hearted man, everyone said, that he did as he'd threatened, and disinherited her entirely. If she's still alive, she'd be living in her late aunt's house, which I suppose she's been in ever since her father's death. She was, by all accounts, bereft. She never continued her studies, and she never married again. Never even flirted with the possibility, from what I understand.
He felt a coldness move over him. And what happened to the man?
Who can say? For many years there were rumors about him. He was sighted here or there. He emigrated to England or the continent. He remarried this or that heiress. But no one ever knew for sure. And at any rate, he was never heard from again. But David, what's wrong? You've gone pale.
It is nothing, he managed to say. I think the fish tonight disagree with me somewhat.
Oh dear, I know you love Saul.
Upstairs, back in the safety of his study, he tried to calm himself. The comparisons, which had risen unbidden, were ludicrous. Yes, Edward knew of his money, but he had never asked for any. He had even been bashful about accepting the blanket, and they were certainly not discussing marriage. But still, something about the story upset him, as if it were an echo of another story, a worse story, a story he had heard once but could not, however he tried, recall. He was unable to sleep that night, and for the first time in a long while, he spent the following morning in bed, waving away the maid's offers of breakfast, staring at a water stain along the baseboard where the two walls met in a V. It was his secret, this patch of yellow, and when he had been confined, he had gazed at it for hours, certain that were he to turn from it or to blink, when he opened his eyes next, the room would be transformed into an unfamiliar place, some place terrifyingly dark and small. A monk's cell, the hold of a ship, the bottom of a well. The stain was what was keeping him in the world, and it demanded all of his concentration. In his confinements, he was sometimes unable to even stand. But now he was not ill, only fearful of something he could not name. And so, finally, he made himself wash and dress, and by the time he'd ventured downstairs, it was already late in the afternoon.
A letter for you, Mr. David.
He felt his heart quicken. Thank you, Matthew. But once he had plucked the letter from the silver tray, he set it on a table and sat, folding his hands in his lap, trying to still his heart, to lengthen and slow his breaths. Finally, cautiously, he stretched out his arm and picked up the letter. It is not from him, he told himself. And it was not. It was another note from Charles, inquiring about his health and asking if he might like to accompany him to a recitation that Friday evening. It is of Shakespeare's sonnets, of which I know you are fond. He sat holding the letter, his disappointment mingling with something he was once again unable to identify. Then before he could hesitate, he rang for Matthew and asked for paper and ink, and quickly scrawled a response to Charles, accepting his invitation, and handed the envelope back to Matthew, telling him to deliver it immediately. Once this was done, his final reserves of strength left him, and he stood and made his slow way upstairs, back to his chambers, where he rang for the maid and told her to tell Adams to tell his grandfather that he was still feeling poorly and would have to miss dinner tonight. And then he stood in the center of his study and looked about him, trying to find something, a book, a painting, a portfolio of drawings, to distract him, to quell the feeling of unease that now arose within him.